Welcome to the conference, everyone. Please note today's program is being recorded. Please stand by.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Reba Winkler at the National Quality Forum. I'm here with Katie Streeter and Jessica Weber in Washington. Thank you all for joining us for this work group call of the pneumonia thoracic CT work group of our pulmonary and critical care endorsement maintenance project. Just a reminder that this is a public call, and we do have audience members listening. At the end of the call, we will provide an opportunity for any public comment, should anyone like to ask a question or make a comment. Also, a transcript of this call and a recording will be posted in a couple of days on NQF's website for others to view. With that, our goal today is for this work group, which is a subset of the entire steering committee for this pulmonary critical care project, is to look at a subset of the measures, particularly those addressing pneumonia, and we do have the one measure for thoracic CTs. Our goal today is to take a look at the preliminary evaluations done by the work group, for you all to have an opportunity to compare your thoughts. We really want to be able to identify the areas where there may be concerns or disagreements, give you an opportunity to discuss those measures and those issues. Our measure developers are with us on this call, so they can respond to any questions. Also, if there may be some follow-up issues, you'd like to have them addressed before our in-person meeting. Fundamentally, our goal is to prepare ourselves to be able to have a discussion at the in-person meeting. Each of you has been assigned one or two measures to be the lead discussant, both on the workgroup call as well as at the meeting. And so we want you to have the benefit of having a chance to discuss the various measures among other workgroup members and become more familiar with the evaluation process as we go forward. So we do have nine measures to discuss today in 2 hours. That will be a bit challenging. The other work groups are doing it, but we do have to be a little bit careful about time. Now, one issue I just want to make committee members aware of, here at staff, we have an apology to grant to give you. There apparently is one other measure for maintenance, Measure 232, which is vital signs in patients with pneumonia, that somehow it fell off our desk and didn't get into your SharePoint folder, didn't get onto our agenda. So we will be circulating the information on that measure to you after this, and we do apologize for that oversight. So we will get to it. We won't skip it, but we won't be able to talk about it today. So are there any questions from the work group members in terms of what we're going to try and do today? Okay. Has David Rue joined us? I know. I think David's a West Coast person. I'm hoping he's got his time zones together. Okay. So maybe we'll skip the first two measures and move down.
David has joined.
I'm sorry?
David Rue has joined.
Oh, great. Okay. Dr. Rue, welcome.
Hi, everyone.
Hi there. We were just about ready to get started talking about the measures, and you do have the first two measures on the agenda. Do you need a little bit of time to get organized, or are you ready to kind of talk about the measures?
Oh, no, I'm ready. And, in fact, okay. I had forwarded a set of slides, which I believe Catherine or Katie had sent to the rest of the team.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes.
So the slides essentially summarize some of the evidence, actually, a large part of the evidence around selected quality indicators. Two of them, the first two measures, 0096 and 0147, are very similar. They're about the empiric antibiotic therapy for CAP and initial antibiotic selection for community-acquired pneumonia. So I'm going to talk about them collectively or together. But I think the key issues are the same for both of them. So while there might be some slight variations, I believe that the key issues that we really need to talk about, is there a strong process outcome link for, you know, the specific empiric antibiotic recommendations, which are essentially based on current IDSA, ATS, CTS guidelines with specific outcomes? And then is there a significant opportunity for improvement? And so I think really I'd like to just focus my discussion on those and then open it up to the group. Does that sound good?
Okay, that sounds good, because those are both sub-criteria for the first area of importance.
Okay. So, you know, I think with regards to the process outcome link, and I've reviewed several of the materials and actually read several of the studies in depth again, and I feel like the crux of the matter is, you know, if you look at the meta-analysis that was published, and this was actually one that was has been updated several times by the Cochrane Review around the antibiotic selection. As most of you are well aware, the IDSA, ATS, CTS guidelines strongly promote the coverage of atypicals. And the question is whether does coverage for atypicals result in better outcomes, no different outcomes, or worse outcomes? And much of our understanding in the earlier years was based on large retrospective analyses. Patrick Gleason, Peter Hauff, you know, and then Brown, you know, Medicare analyses finding a very strong association between coverage for atypicals, reduced 30-day mortality. And I think that's been a large part of the justification of why this is a quality indicator. The question is, now that we have some more data around randomized controlled trials, and a meta-analysis and around this, and that meta-analysis has been updated several times, most recently looked at in 2010, does that change our opinion about this? And if you'll reflect on slide 4 and the deck I sent, it was just a summary of the Cochrane Review, 25 randomized controlled trials, finding no difference in mortality between atypicals and non-atypicals, and a subgroup, which was actually presented in both the next two slides, of looking at specifically North American studies. Only three of them, not a huge number of patients, but nonetheless, randomized controlled trials, not retrospective, finding no difference as well. So I'm going to pause there because I think that in itself is a conundrum. You know, do we feel that we should just say that, well, these were done in European, or and we don't really acknowledge that the Cochrane is a sufficiently valid study, or do we feel that you know, something else? So I'll pause and see if there's questions, thoughts in terms of what I've just shared.
All right. Any comments from the other work group members?
This is John Pellicone. I'm still a practicing pulmonologist. You know, I can tell you that the concerns about atypicals, and most recently, at least in the patient group that I see, and that is, you know, adults who could potentially have pertussis as a co-infection. You know, the use of the coverage for the atypicals on an empiric basis certainly seems to be a successful approach, especially when cultures are negative, as they so often are in the hospitalized patients with pneumonia. So from the clinical and practical perspective, you know, covering those atypicals certainly makes sense.
This is Don Yealy. I guess I'm always troubled about mandating the atypical coverage up front.
Mm-hmm.
When, in fact, the vast majority either don't have it or respond well to the coverage even absent that. And what you showed in the data collection is that it really is hard to prove a patient-centered outcome benefit. I have no doubt that they're individuals, that it seems like a pretty good idea, but we're creating or endorsing kind of a systematic approach to this that it's just not clear to me the evidence is behind the dual therapy.
Any other thoughts from the work group members? Okay, would any of our measure developers, either from Oklahoma, Dale, I know you're on the line, or from PCPI, any comments from you all?
Yeah, well, this is Dale. I don't have the information that Dave sent out, so I wasn't able to see it. So I think
if you're on the webinar, we're projecting it, but we can send it to you, Dale.
I am on the webinar, I think. Let me just, so the performance measure, at least the CMS performance measure for inpatients, does have some patient categories for which dual coverage is not required. And the performance measure also is I think we have to be a little bit cautious talking about atypical coverage, remembering that the performance measure includes two populations of patients, and that includes those in the non-ICU and the ICU setting. In the ICU setting, whether atypical coverage is important or not is arguable, although particularly in patients that are very sick or septic, the at least the members of our technical expert panel, which is most of the authors of the IDSA ATS performance or guidelines, still strongly recommend considering atypical coverage in that population that are particularly ill. The other thing that we had demonstrated in the past, again, a retrospective review, was that atypical coverage seemed to vary certain years, certain times of the year, and certain sections of the country. We didn't find the effect of reduced mortality in all sections of the country at the same time. And not all times of the year, but certainly in the fall and the early, the winter months, we found that atypical coverage seemed to have more of an impact on mortality based on our retrospective reviews. The performance measure from the CMS standpoint is reviewed by the technical expert panel every 3 months. They recently made some changes to the performance measure on antibiotic selection that broadened choices, particularly in the ICU setting, to account for sepsis protocols that hospitals have in place around the country, and also address one of the newer antibiotics that's on the market that has been trialed in non-ICU patients. So tigecycline, as an example, was added as an acceptable alternative because of clinical trials showing its effectiveness. But the performance measure is routinely recommended by the our technical expert panel. Every 3 months we meet, and again, the panel includes most of the members of the writing panel for IDSA and ATS.
Thanks, Joe. Anything further from the work group? David?
I think one thing that, you know, is probably important for us to kind of establish up front is whether or not, you know, guidelines are certainly, this is absolutely an important guideline, the difference between a guideline and a quality indicator. And if we feel that, you know, to become a quality indicator, there has to be a proven or a definitive process outcome link, or there has to be one in which it's suggestive, or and then you can fill in the rest with expert opinion. Because I think we'll, as we go through some of the others, we'll find that maybe there isn't as strong a process outcome link as we'd like, but expert opinion would suggest that it is the right thing to do. And I'd like some guidance to know how much of this should be based on proven process outcome versus expert opinion. Okay. That will help me determine whether or not
sure.
These are appropriate quality indicators as opposed to guidelines.
If you look at the details of the measure evaluation criteria, you'll find that we really are trying to focus in on evidence. However, there are exceptions because, as you mentioned, there are these sorts of circumstances, so that with, you know, we don't expect this to happen a lot because we really do want measures that are well-grounded in good studies and the evidence. But if there is a compelling argument, such as perhaps might be the case in this circumstance, that the consensus around it, certainly that's something the steering committee can acknowledge and form the basis of your recommendation.
Yeah, and this is Don. That's actually my concern, is that there's a difference between a recommendation and a quality indicator. And I understand the recommendation, but as presented, we heard was the benefit varies time of year per location, and even then the evidence, systematic evidence doesn't really support. So it's just hard to move that into being a baseline measurement of the quality of care, particularly de-linked to an outcome. I struggle with that. I don't struggle with the about, you know, providing antibiotics. I struggle with this particular dual coverage for all comers up front, because we're hearing all the variation in it, and it's hard to imagine that individual practitioners' judgments, which may be not congruous with our quality metric would are really putting people at harm.
So this is Dale again. I want to make one thing pretty clear in that the performance measure actually doesn't necessarily require dual coverage for all patients. So, in fact, there are four different options for the non-ICU population. They include ticagrelor monotherapy, fluoroquinolone monotherapy, beta-lactam plus the macrolide or doxycycline. And then in that one group of patients, those patients that are relatively young, that don't have risk factors for drug resistance, macrolide monotherapy actually is acceptable for that population of patients. And all that's built into the performance measure. The only group for which we currently have a performance metric that requires dual coverage is the ICU population. It turns out nationally, at least in the inpatient quality reporting system, that about 12% of the inpatients end up in the intensive care unit. And for that group of patients, and remember that the performance measure specifies that the reason for admission to ICU has to be because of pneumonia. And for that population, the performance metric does require dual therapy as recommended in the guidelines.
Yeah, I apologize for the term dual therapy, but with the exception of the macrolide monotherapy in the less sick, many locations, what we're talking about is dual therapy because the monotherapy option is less attractive in certain sites because of the downstream consequences. So we're forcing people to make a choice that in fact has unintended consequences, and we can't prove that it is a true quality patient-linked outcome benefit, except in tiny groups, subsets that seem to vary in locations and over time. So I'm just uncomfortable requiring the atypical coverage in all.
So Dale, is it fair to say that the IDSA, ATS, and CMS quality indicators around this do not support beta-lactam or cephalosporin monotherapy?
That is correct.
Because that was the analysis that specifically the Cochrane looked at, looking at quinolones pretty much versus the beta-lactam mono and not finding the difference. And that's why, you know, I think the question is, if someone were to do just, you know, ceftriaxone or whatever without the macrolide or even the quinolone added, then that's considered poor care. And the question is, you know, is the evidence support that as being poor care?
Well, and of course, as you know, I mean, most of those performance measures and the guidelines were built upon those very large retrospective reviews. I'm not sure which three North American trials you had in the Cochrane analysis. I don't remember which three individual studies were there or how big those RCTs were. I can't comment on those three.
Yeah, they were really small. I mean, Herala, Doulas, 1991. You know, about 50 patients, Kahn, 1989, about 120, Peterson, 1988, about 60 patients. So
I think that makes a good point because when you look at the large retrospective studies that were done showing benefit of the combined therapy, most of which had tens of thousands of patients, the absolute differences in mortality were relatively small. So a randomized controlled trial prospective would have to be very large to demonstrate the differences in mortality. And yet the position has always been that it's relevant because just in the Medicare program alone, there are about 700,000 pneumonia hospitalizations annually.
Right. Certainly the amount of volume in the retrospective is overwhelming, and I think that's certainly why it is a quality indicator to date. I guess the question, you know, with the biases inherent in a retrospective analysis versus a randomized controlled trial, what we're left with here is for the RCT is just very small studies. And so does that even throw into question this, or does this, and again, here's where I don't know where to draw the line. Do we feel that, you know, the information that's been put forward is something that we should just say, yeah, we know, but we don't believe it or we don't acknowledge it because of A, B, C, D reasons? Or do we say that, hey, this kind of throws into question whether or not, since we don't have that large multi-center randomized controlled trial to look at this, whether or not this actually does have that strong process outcome link.
Yeah, and I guess my concern is the retrospective trials are really, they were powerful, but they are awfully dated in addition to the inherent limits of it. And again, I fall back to, I understand how they could help drive a guideline or a recommendation, but is it the best evidence to use for determining quality?
I guess the only other thing that I will add, and I'm sure you all understand this, that we do routinely meet with the technical expert panel and review these issues. I do know, I don't know where it's at. I believe IDSA ATS are reformulating their guideline committee to relook at their update their guidelines. I think they're working on maybe healthcare associated first, but I do believe they are working on updating their guidelines, and we do try to keep on top of any changes in guideline recommendations and incorporate those into the performance measure. So if you look at this performance measure today, it's very, very different than it was just 2 years ago.
Okay, this is Reva. I think we're going to need to move on to some of the other criteria. David, you had mentioned that you had some issues around the opportunity for improvement as well. Why don't you comment on measure 96 on that criterion? Did I lose you?
Oh, I'm sorry, I was on mute. specifically, as we think about what is publicly available right now in the Hospital Compare database, and you look at the nationwide adherence rate to this quality indicator, we're at 94%, and that's nationwide. And so the question is 90, at what threshold do we believe we've kind of got to the point of diminishing returns where, you know, is it 90%? Is it 95? Is it 97? I know at one point beta blockers were taken off because they, we had achieved such a high rate of adherence, but I don't know what that threshold is. Maybe you could give me some insight into at what point do we say that we've got a pretty high level of adherence?
This is Chuck Stemple, and I think I'm the only managed care person on this, and certainly when we look at measures for our physician and hospital practices, anything that gets to 94%, we assume there's going to be minimal to no improvement, just obviously from some specific variation in care that's going to occur. So I would think removing this would be appropriate with that level of attainment of the measure and relooking, you know, at a period of time down the road to see if it's maintained that level of performance.
Other thoughts from other folks? Let me just throw in sort of another wrinkle to this whole thing is we certainly have seen measures that have been perhaps victims of their own success. A great many of them that have been reported on Hospital Compare for quite a while. Concern that the measures are still very good measures. They meet all of the other criteria, particularly for scientific acceptability, usability, feasibility, but that the opportunity for improvement is probably limited going forward. We have created a new status for those measures, which is called a reserve status. It's sort of like we put them on the shelf, acknowledging they're still good measures, but their utility in driving additional improvement may be limited, but they do still are considered endorsed measures. So if indeed you all feel that the measure meets all of the other criteria solidly, then that is an additional option for a measure you feel has very limited opportunity for improvement going forward.
Hey, Reva, can I just make one point again?
Yeah.
Remember, there's actually two measures embedded here. Joint Commission breaks them out into the non-ICU and the ICU population. It's actually, and I don't have that breakout in front of me, the ICU population is where we see lower rates of performance of the guideline-recommended antibiotics. So there is a little bit of difference between the two populations.
Dale, I know that you keep trend data as well, and perhaps that might be useful to see what change has occurred over the past, couple of years in those two populations. And perhaps that would be helpful to the committee in understanding where they think this measure has additional opportunity.
Looking to see if I can pull up trend data.
Yeah. Well, I think that's something that perhaps we might be able to provide to the committee before our in-person meeting and before they make their final recommendations.
Yeah, I think that's a critical point to see. It's a good point that if it's been at this level for a couple years or just achieved, so the trend would be nice to see before that final decision. So
okay.
It'd be nice to have.
Now, so this was measure 147, the hospital measure. Were there any concerns among any of the committee members on the other criteria for scientific acceptability, usability, or feasibility? In general, what I see on the four people that submitted your preliminary ratings is generally moderate to highs with a sense that it does meet the criteria. So David's concern, I think, was the one that he has raised and you've had an opportunity to discuss. So was there anything else about the hospital measure per se? And I think it would be very helpful to get that additional data from the developers prior to our in-person meeting. Okay, then let's look at 96, which is the clinician level measure from PCPI. Again, David mentioned it's very similar. David, did you have any have concerns about the opportunity for improvement here?
You know, and here's one where I'd actually like to get some of the more raw data and utilization or adherence rates. I didn't have that because I know hospital compare, I think it's mostly inpatient, right? So if there are sources out there that can better identify it, I think that would really be the same approach that we should take for the inpatient as well as outpatient.
Okay. Alvia? Who's on from PCPI?
Hi, Dr. Wingo. This is Sam Tierney with the PCPI. Hi. The data that we have from this measure regarding the most current national usage comes from the PQRS program. And so we could certainly, I noticed that our submission forms lack information on the 2009 performance rate, which is the most current information that's been made publicly available. So we could certainly share that, but we probably don't have a level of detail that you would have access to from Hospital Compare just because of the nature of the program, of the PQRS program as opposed to the Hospital Compare program. But I can tell you the 2009 performance rate, the mean performance rate was 92.18%. Unfortunately, the data does not indicate the variation across, and I know that for the 2008 data that we did receive from CMS, that there was quite a bit of variability from the 10th percentile to, for example, the 90th percentile. So that's the current data we have. We could certainly add that additional information about 2009 if that would be helpful.
I think that would be good. Yeah, mean, median, and mode, and also variation would all be interesting things to know.
All right, David. In terms of for measure 96, were there any other concerns on scientific acceptability, usability, or feasibility? In general, what I see in the initial ratings were moderate to high ratings, without any significant issues identified. Is that a fair summary? Okay. Just in the interest of time, we need to move on to some of the other measures. Were there any other issues about the empiric antibiotic therapy for either hospitals or clinicians anybody wanted to raise before we move on? Okay. So I think let's move on to the next measure, which is measure 148. And this is blood cultures performed in the emergency department prior to an initial antibiotic received in the hospital. This is a measure from CMS at the hospital level. And Dr. Yulee, I think it's your turn.
Okay. So this is one where we saw quite a big spread in the analysis of the evidence. Where essentially every grade was given across the three of us who scored it. this measure requires that if blood cultures are to be obtained, that they be obtained before antibiotics are given in the emergency department. And the concern is that it's not linked really to a health outcome. And the evidence that this particular process of care improves either a broad patient-based outcome or surrogate for that is actually fairly weak. And primarily that is based on the fact that blood cultures themselves in pneumonia as defined in this measure are infrequently a tool that will alter care. Therefore, the drawing before or after empiric antibiotic therapy could not possibly be used as a quality indicator because there isn't really. We all understand drawing a blood culture after administering antibiotic doesn't make a lot of intellectual sense, but it's hard to link that to some change in a patient-centered outcome or interfering with the ability to change an outcome. So if you look at the supportive evidence, it's actually fairly small, observational-based, lots of confounding potential. And the second concern is that the actual timing of the blood culture sampling and the antibiotic administration, while each can be captured in an electronic record, it's not clear that the accuracy of the specific event, in other words, the timing of the culture versus the initiation of the antibiotic therapy, is reliable. It may be actually accurate, but it may not be reliable at the same moment in time. In other words, little bits of differences in time depending on how HR logs these could present a dramatically different picture, even if you believed the measure was scientifically valid. So my concern is that I don't think there's a lot of science behind this, and it can't possibly improve outcomes in most people. Therefore, it's very difficult to use as a quality measure.
Thoughts from any of the other committee members on the importance criteria, particularly the evidence that Dr. Ely is raising?
Yeah, this is Dave Rue. I would agree with Dr. Ely. In fact, if you look at the slides that I forwarded, I've provided some very specific examples of all the different studies that have looked at blood cultures, and you can see that starting with a systematic review, it doesn't impact in a good number of cases the care, especially for immunocompetent patients. And then additionally, I've done my own analysis, and you can see on some of the slides, there do appear to be some certainly variations between ICU, the yield, and non-ICU. So maybe there is perhaps a subcategory there we might want to consider. But if you look specifically at clinical outcomes, mortality specifically, there doesn't seem to be differences when you look, try to look specifically at the clinical outcomes. The one study in which there was a trend towards improvement in outcomes was the one by Thomas Meehan, which is sort of the classic JAMA 1997 one, but subsequent ones, which are smaller in nature, have not been able to demonstrate that definitively. So, I'm sort of thinking, does it make sense? Certainly give it before antibiotics. You can see that the data represent that it dramatically improves the yield, but the question is there a strong process outcome link? And I'm not entirely convinced of that.
Yeah, this is Reva, just to let you know, one of the other measures that is on the list that was evaluated by the critical care work group is indeed the blood cultures for patients admitted to the ICU. So there is another measure.
Right, and my concern, we talked about this before the pre-call, or during the pre-call, was that the two measures are overlapping but not necessarily congruent. In other words, the other measure, which we're not here to discuss, actually sanctions obtaining a blood culture almost at any moment in time, irrespective of the timing of empiric antibiotic therapy. And it just strikes me as odd to have ones that are that overlapping, but in theory could be dyssynergy or dyssynchronous. It's just hard for this one. You mentioned the Tom Meehan trial. We actually designed one of our trials based on that, and Tom was a co-investigator. If I could have taken it back, I used it as a quality metric in a trial. And once you standardize the other process of care, it actually falls completely away. His data set, it was likely a surrogate for we're doing a better job paying attention to people with pneumonia rather than the specific act.
So would you recommend the other work group potentially keeping their ICU and us removing this one, if I'm hearing you?
Well, if I had to choose, if I had to make a choice between keeping one and getting rid of one, that's the direction I would go. I did not spend a lot of time, because I wasn't assigned to that group, on examining the ICU-only data on that. So I guess I feel a little uncomfortable making any comments there, but I don't think having these two together makes a lot of sense, and this strikes me as being as a weak measure.
Okay.
Yeah. I would support removing it and then letting the ICU group decide the validity in the ICU, but I think that would make more sense.
Just remember that ultimately at our meeting in March, the entire committee, including you all, will make decisions about all of the measures, including that one. But they have discussed that measure as well.
Okay.
So, Reba, can I just make just one quick point?
Sure. Dale, go ahead.
I'm sorry. And so I want to make it clear that blood cultures are not required. There's a lot of confusion in the provider community, but there's no requirement to do a blood culture on a pneumonia patient for this particular measure. That the decision to do the blood culture is left entirely to the clinician at the bedside. It only applies to patients when they're in the emergency department. Once they leave the emergency department or actually have orders for admission, they're excluded from the measure denominator. So we're only looking at those patients when they first come in. If somebody decides to do a blood culture, do they draw it before the antibiotics are given? And I will not disagree with Dave or anybody else about the process outcome link if you're looking at the outcome being mortality or patient length of stay or anything else. The reason that the technical panel has continued to support blood cultures, and there's been controversy around blood cultures, but they've supported it for reasons other than patient outcomes, in part to identify the epidemiology of pneumonia within an organization, to actually get culture data and to know what your resistance patterns are. So that's why in the IDSA guidelines, they have a very limited category of patients, but they do have specific populations for whom they do recommend blood cultures. Most of the trials that Dave talked about showing no mortality benefit are the ones where blood cultures will often routinely be done on all patients, and that is not required in this measure.
You know, speaking on behalf of the emergency medicine community, I don't think there's confusion about you don't have to draw them. It's just of the value. And secondly, the occasional trap that the electronic capture of the timing of the two interventions can give the illusion of antibiotic before blood culture when, in fact, it didn't even exist. And so you have almost a double whammy. You're measuring something that only rarely provides microbiologic evidence and almost never alters the clinical actions, and then occasionally creates a false sense of lack of compliance. Invariably, these are captured at two different levels, although stored in electronic records. So I think it creates an even bigger problem. The best way to be compliant with the measure, at least that I hear from the ED community, is to have a wide spacing between these two so that there can't be any confusion about when each particular event was logged. If you think about it, what we're doing is we're telling people to withhold the clearly helpful therapy, which is antibiotics, so that the clearly unhelpful event doesn't create any confusion. I realize they don't have to do. The alternative would be to just not draw the blood cultures at all, but sometimes there are other reasons, or people have done it for what they believe is the right reason and then get essentially whacked over the head.
Okay. Just because, you know, it sounds like this is going to be an important decision point issue, but are there any other concerns about this measure for either the opportunity for improvement or the scientific acceptability, usability, feasibility of this measure?
Well, I think the feasibility is what I've talked about as far as tracking. It goes into that also, the ability to accurately track the timing of the interventions, particularly since it's measured in the emergency department, where the interventions are in minutes to hour as opposed to hours to days. And so it actually is not particularly hard to misidentify the timing of events, even with an electronic health record.
So I assume you're saying the validity of the data would be very low and would not be supported in terms of, is validity the correct word, or the timing to really create it, this is the clinical outcome measures?
Yeah, I'm saying I don't think the link to an outcome measures and the feasibility of collecting information accurately on these two independent events, I think, is under question.
Yeah, being an ER doc, though I haven't practiced in a while, I would say the timed order entry would be highly suspect, and yes, I would totally agree with you.
All right. Does anybody else have anything they want to say on measure 148 before we move on? Okay. The next measure we want to talk about is measure 231. This is inpatient pneumonia mortality rate. This is an IQI from ARC. I think this is a measure of an outcome measure that's been around for quite a while. And again, Dr. Yulee, I think this is yours to discuss.
Okay. Just one, I suspect there's a lot less concern. It looks like the scoring is grouped together fairly well. Essentially looks at the ultimate, you know, the kingpin of outcomes, which is dead or alive at some interval, with a patient group that is easily identified. There is some question about the homogeneity of the group. I actually don't have any concerns about the underlying evidence about this. The only threat to the criteria that I see is the ability to contemporaneously and accurately assess the risk of the illness or the acute illness burden isn't incorporated into this for obvious reasons, and that it's meant to be a simple metric. And it potentially could profoundly impact on the mortality rate and be fairly independent of the quality of the care delivered. In other words, if site A had mostly class 4 and 5 using the pneumonia severity index patients and site B had mostly class 1 and 2, site B might have a death rate that's double what's predicted but look a whole lot better than site A for reasons unrelated to quality of care. I'm not as bothered by that because we have some of the other core elements of either the pneumonia severity index, the CURB tool, or the SCAP score in some of the other measures. So while that type of data anomaly in theory could throw off one metric, you would likely pay the price in a different metric. And so I'm not as bothered by that. And my read on this and looking at the rest of the scores is that we don't have a lot of problem with it.
Yeah. Just a comment. John, are you on the line? Anybody from ARC?
Yeah, John.
Hi, John. Did you want to respond?
I'm largely gathering notes for the forthcoming call. The risk adjustment is spelled out in the application, and perhaps there's aspects of what you could potentially adjust for risk on that are not present in the current risk adjustment. Oftentimes we have to go into some detail to explain how all patient-refined DRGs are truly integrated into the risk adjustment, and we can do that more at that time.
Okay.
Right. And, you know, measure 1895 and 233, those are two of the big-ticket risk adjusters right there.
Okay.
At least in acute illness.
So it sounds like, does anybody else on the work group have any other issues or concerns they want to raise about measure 231? Okay, the outcome measure was the easy one. All right. Okay, then let's move on to 233, which is assessment of oxygen saturation for community-acquired pneumonia. Dr. Pelicone, I think this is your measure?
Correct. So on the surface, this seems rather straightforward. It's a non-invasive test, and it's a piece of data that you really cannot assess accurately just by looking at the patient. And I certainly think it's certainly more appropriate to have this kind of information than just throwing patients on oxygen, which is what we see frequently. The reduction in oxygen saturation does, however, have to be taken in the context of the patient's pre-morbid or pre-pneumonia state, which, you know, and the measure here doesn't necessarily discuss, but I think is inherent in the interpretation of the numbers. And there's no doubt that given the information about hypoxemia being associated with more severe cases and worse outcomes, it's certainly indicated if there are other factors about the patient that point toward an ICU-type pneumonia admission. So and it looks pretty straightforward.
Okay.
This is Don. You know, obviously this is a big part of the – I guess it's not – if it's not clear to everybody else, that the pneumonia severity index is our work here. And I'm not even as bothered by the acute versus pre-existing hypoxemia because in the large data sets, the timing of the organ dysfunction doesn't seem to be as important as do you have it together with the pneumonia. So whether even if you had pre-existing, I don't. That just is a different type of negative effect on predicting the outcome. It actually doesn't mitigate it all that much. So this is another one that's simple. The only concern I would have about this is. What's the frequency of the current use, and is there still opportunity for improvement? My gut feeling is from looking at the data and realizing that while we think this should be done in 100% of the cases, there is still room for improvement. And this is the kind of action that I would still think we would put our foot on the gas, even if compliance was above 90%. It's so incredibly basic and a helpful tool that from other things we talked about, once you got much over 90, particularly on the action kind of things, that maybe there wouldn't be quite the bang for the buck. I'm not as convinced in oxygen assessment that is true. And until we get, if we consistently hit 98 and above, I suspect that there's not much public health benefit, but I don't think we're there yet.
This is Reeva. I'll ask Sam Tierney again. Sam, is this another measure where perhaps you've got the 2009 PQRS data?
Yes, we do have that. And again, sorry, it wasn't included in the submission. The mean performance rate for 2009 was 92.72%. But again, we don't have the variability for 2009, but we do have the variability for 2008, which indicates quite a difference from the 10th percentile to the 90th.
That's really helpful. And I guess my point would be, different from some of the other ones, this is one that I would strongly recommend that we keep our foot on the gas.
Hi, this is Dave Rue. It's interesting because as you look at the literature on this, clearly there's not an outcome association in terms of mortality, but a lot of the outcomes are associated with sort of delays in terms of the impact of a delay of oxygenation assessment. And yet the measure that we're looking at is simply a yes or no, was it performed or not. I'm wondering whether or not it would actually make more sense to add an element of timing, like perhaps within 1 hour or something of that sort, because isn't that really more important than just simply having it done perhaps, you know, sometime during whatever time period? Is the timing element the real important piece that we're not capturing here?
This is Don, and I actually would have no gripe about that any time in the first few hours as an assessment tool. It is linked to the outcome because you can't prognose the outcome, ergo tailor therapy if you don't actually know the risk assessment. And no matter which tool you use, this is going to be part of it. There's no way around it.
Right, and clearly if you do it early, it seems to be associated with better outcomes. But,
right.
You know, just someone could satisfy the measure and simply do it at the very tail end, and that, you know, what's the point of that?
The only rub is I don't know when the exact right time it is. So we'd be, speaking very bluntly, we'd be making it up. The PSI data, which is probably the largest on this, just referred to first oxygen assessment, but that could have been any time during the ED stay.
The study by Blott in critical care medicine in 2007, they found that a delay of greater than 1 hour in the oxygen assessment was associated with increased time to antibiotic therapy. And they also find that a greater than 3 hours of delay of the oxygen assessment was associated with increased mortality. Clearly 1 hour, 3 hours is too late. 1 hour is probably, less than an hour is probably optimal. But, it's something we could probably discuss in further detail. But I do think that there are some parameters laid out in the literature that we could use as a basis.
And we're talking about this in the emergency room?
I don't think this one is ED specific. Well, and so if you're admitted through the emergency department, which across the U.S. on average, 75% of people with pneumonia are. But I have to switch to a different file. But I didn't think this one was ED specific.
It doesn't say ED, so we would if we put a time frame, it would be upon patient arrival, either to ED or inpatient. I would assume it would not be site specific. Then we would expect that in the ED as well as an inpatient bed.
Exactly, irrespective of the entry portal, and
yeah.
Given the mortality data we talked about, I'd probably lean towards the 3 hour because we have a hard stop there. I recognize I'm not arguing that doing it at 2 hours and 59 minutes is a great thing. But it's what the data support with little debate.
Yeah, this is Reva, and the suggestions back to the measure developer on ways to improving the measure is definitely in bounds for everybody, but realize that at this point we're really asking you to make an assessment of the measure as is, and so keep that in mind when you're doing your evaluation. All right, were there any concerns or issues about the reliability and validity of this measure? They do present the evidence or the results of their testing, particularly of the EHR measure. We've got, one rating of moderate and one rating of high. Any comments or thoughts from the committee on how well it meets that criterion?
So I'm the one who forgot to put in a different score. I would have given it high.
Okay.
This is John Pellicone. I just have a question about, is there an assumption here that the person recording the saturation is familiar enough with the equipment to know when a cool and vascularly constricted finger is not giving an adequate assessment of the absorption of the two wavelengths of light through that pulse? I mean, is that assumed in the measure?
This is Don. I actually didn't read that into the measurement because the point is seeking it in itself is a potentially helpful event.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You get the patient you described, you get a different type of useful information. I realize that's not really what we're trying to benchmark here, but I just didn't read that into the measure.
Okay.
All right. I would ask the members of the work group that have not entered your ratings for these measures, if you could do so since you have reviewed them, it would help give a more comprehensive summary when we go to the meeting in March. Does anybody else have any comments about Measure 233 before we move on to the next one? All right. If not, then we've got two outcome measures. The first one is measure 506. This is the hospital 30-day all-cause risk standardized readmission rate following pneumonia hospitalization. This comes to us from CMS. And I believe we've got our developers from CMS and Yale on the line with us. And so, Dr. Stemple, I think 506 was your measure to lead.
Okay. I apologize. I didn't realize this was my measure to lead, so I absolute apology about that.
Okay. How about any other members of the work group? Several of you have submitted ratings. And generally have rated it a fairly well. In terms of importance, this is an outcome measure. Readmission rates are considered outcome measures, so that sort of takes care of the evidence there. The opportunity for improvement that has been submitted shows that the mean readmission rate was 18.4% with a range of 13 to 26. Interquartile range of 17 to 19. Any other thoughts on the importance criteria from the work group?
Well, and I'm sorry not having the data at my hand. So critically within, with all clinical arenas and certainly managed care, I think this is one of the critical issues looking at effectiveness of initial therapy and certainly the readmission rate for this population. And I would certainly support it as a critical issue, a clinical outcome measure. And even as we look further now, you know, within our populations, more in the Medicare world, and I don't know if there's reason to look at readmissions from SNF or LTACs or rehab, because we're having more focused on those readmissions and are people getting appropriate care and alternative level of cares and those nosocomial infections in those environments. So I didn't see data separating out readmissions from other, you know, downstream facilities, not acute inpatient, but I don't know if there's an opportunity to look at separating readmission discharge to home and readmission if discharged to a SNF, LTAC rehab, or other post-acute care type of facility.
Do our folks from Yale maybe want to comment?
You want us to comment specifically on the focus on readmissions from those settings?
Yeah, I mean, did those get captured in this measure at all?
Yes. So we don't, the measure doesn't look, sorry, this is Susanna Bernheim from Yale. I should have introduced myself. We don't look at the discharge disposition, so it's an all-cause readmission measure. So patients, once they are discharged to a non-acute setting, they are included in the measure, but we don't differentiate either within this measure about where they are coming back from. But those patients are certainly included.
What, was there consideration in looking at population as a separate measure, or was there thoughts that, that separation would not be a clinically valid distinction, or would you mind thoughts on separating that population out?
Sure. So there was some thought given to that. In general, our feeling has been that it's important to look at all-cause readmission, regardless of the discharge disposition, as a more holistic way to evaluate what's happening at a hospital. But more specifically to this question, one concern when thinking about this is that some amount of where you go has to do with sort of regional supply. So there may be areas of the country where patients, because of availability, are more likely to go into those settings and other areas where they aren't. So that might not be a particularly fair comparison. And when we've looked more for heart failure than pneumonia, we do see an incredible range in terms of the percentage of patients that go into different settings, and we have not seen a real relationship between what percentage of patients are going into, say, a skilled nursing facility setting and the readmission rate. So we have not felt like that was particularly useful for this measure. I do think that there are efforts in other parts of CMS to look more specifically at readmission from long-term care settings, but this measure does not do that.
Okay.
This is John Pellicone. I just want to clarify one point there. So if the patient goes home and on the first day home, on the 31st day, or the 29th day, fractures a leg and comes back, that's counted in as the readmission.
Right. So for this measure, it's an all-cause readmission measure, and the important thing is we're not expecting readmissions to be zero. There will be both useful readmissions, important readmissions, and there will be accidental, completely non-preventable readmissions, but our expectation is, because it's a comparison to what's expected, that those are going to be randomly distributed, and that won't make a hospital look particularly worse.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. In terms of the work group, thoughts on the reliability and validity of this measure, I will point you there to a very detailed document that describes the evaluation of the measure in an all-payer data set. Previously, this measure had been restricted to patients over the age of 65 because of the Medicare data. However, just in the past year, with encouragement by lots and lots of stakeholders, the developers have tested this in an all-payer data set so that, and found that the risk model that they use is appropriate, reliable, and valid for use for all patients admitted with pneumonia. And so I would point you to that, that data in terms of the reliability and validity of this measure and the fairly comprehensive risk model. Any thoughts or concerns from members of the work group on the reliability and validity and risk adjustment for this measure?
This is Don. The only question I have is how do we handle the second healthcare contact if the patient is not formally admitted but placed in an observation status. That's the workaround that I would expect. And how is that handled? That's a great